Hi, Senator.
How are you doing? How are you doing?
How are you doing this morning?
Pretty good. I got back to Washington on time last night, about 15 minutes early. That's pretty good for American Airlines. Yeah. How are you doing?
Doing fairly well. It's been kind of a goofy morning, but as long as the Hawks keep winning.
Yeah. Hey, you know why the Hawks are in the top 25 or top 10 now? Because they weren't rated preseason. And if they're rated preseason, they're going to have a bad season. But if they aren't rated, they're going to have a good season. That's my rule of thumb.
It's worked out like that.
More than once it's worked out that way.
First of all, thank you very much for the tour. It was excellent. Just had a wonderful time. We had a tour of the Capitol. They're still in number 10, by the way.
You liked the tour?
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was my favorite. And we went and we saw Arlington, and we saw the Holocaust Museum, that was my favorite, was the tour of the Capitol.
Yeah. Do you know that I get more compliments probably on the tour that my staff gives of the Capitol building than any other thing that we do?
Well, our guide, and now his name is slipping me, but he was just really, really good. He's a senior this year. I know that.
You're talking about Nick, aren't you?
Yes, Nick.
Yeah.
He was absolutely excellent.
Yeah.
Just excellent. Let me ask you first about Senator Thompson. Senator Thompson was a friend of the radio station, and we carried some town meetings that he held here when he was running for president in 2007. It's a big law.
Yeah, from so many standpoints. A pretty good legal mind. He demonstrated that with the Watergate committee. He was a very good actor, as you can tell. He was a very involved senator and spoke infrequently, but when he spoke, he was listened to. And I think all around, the only thing maybe he didn't excel at was being a presidential candidate. I don't know that I was convinced that he really wanted to be president. He asked if I would walk around with him at the state fair, and I would always try to get him to shake hands with Mary Smith or Ken Brown or this guy or that woman, and I couldn't get him out of the crowd that he had around him, which was 90% of them television cameras. The best way I think to campaign at the state fair is to shake hands with as many people as you could. But it seemed to me that he was kind of bound by the number of television cameras. In fact, the joke probably goes, and I don't know whether it's meant as a joke or somebody thought it was serious, but I was with him, and they said, "Look, Chuck Grassley's running for president. He's got a movie star with him." See, but he was a very good senator. And let me explain to you that one of the, if you ask me five or six bills that I'm proud that I sponsored, one of them would be called the Congressional Accountability Act. And he was very involved with me in that legislation. And the Congressional Accountability Act applied all the laws of that Congress had exempted itself, going back to the wage and hour law of 1938, all the way up to some legislation in 1990, about 15 very important pieces of legislation. They applied to everybody in the country except Capitol Hill. And I thought that it wasn't right to have one type of laws for Washington and another type of laws for the rest of the country. And so I got those bills now applied to Congress. And he was very major in helping me get that done.
Well, he came to us and said he's going to do these town meetings, and he did them at Iowa River Power. And he said, I'd like you to broadcast it, and of course we did. But I got to ask him, I said, you know, how come you didn't go to the big corporation here? How come you didn't go to Third Channel? And he said, I was in this town driving through one morning, and you guys are kind of seat of the pants, and your mom and pop operation, I picked that up right away, and I kind of liked that. And that's why he chose us. And he's just very, 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 very nice, gentleman.
Yeah.
Good handshake and told great story.
Well, that voice he had was the voice of a president.
Yeah. I think he would have made a good president. He just was pretty down to earth, and he knew the art of compromise.
Yeah.
So, it is a law. Explain this to me, because this is one of the things that you're working on, with the cell phone, the spying through the cell phone.
I
didn't understand the whole thing.
Okay. I forget the technical term for it, or there's kind of a nickname for it, but whatever it is, they will put airplanes in the air to monitor cell phone calls, and the point is, we want to know whether or not there's a reasonable, you know, under the Fourth Amendment, reasonable cessation of a crime being committed, or somebody that they have to arrest for a crime, and that they aren't just willy-nilly listening in and picking up something that they didn't have any reason to be suspected of. And it's kind of, and the extent to which a warrant might be needed, are they getting warrants? We want to make sure the Fourth Amendment is followed, the right of privacy, the right to be secured in your home. The other argument would be, well, if you're talking on the cell phone, it's pretty much in the air, so anybody could pick it up, you know. But it's quite a bit different if law enforcement is using it as an excuse to arrest somebody, the extent to which the Fourth Amendment is being followed.
Okay. Yeah, because it just they're actually putting planes in the air that wouldn't fly around the cell towers?
I think that they, I don't know the technology, but I presume they have an opportunity to make a very broad sweep of a big geographical area and several cell phone towers when you do it by airplane. How high up, I don't know, the plane is. I suppose it's some relationship to what they can intercept. The geographical area it would cover, but they sweep in, you know, I don't know whether it's hundreds of millions or billions of calls that are being made, or even if it's tens of millions, you know, what one or two things are they looking for? And are they following the Constitution in the process of doing it? That's what we're very concerned about.
Yeah, it's darn scary, and really, all this information. The problem I have with the cell phones is all this information. Like you say, it's being transmitted, and it's on a frequency. And I wonder just how secure it actually is for anybody to, not just the government, but anybody that can dial in on those frequencies could hear and take down information.
Well, you know, for a long period of time, you know, we know that police stations have had monitors to monitor various things if they wanted to. Going back a long time before cell phones monitoring two-way radio, as an example, was something that the police had been doing for a long period of time right in your local police station. Now, of course, people aren't using that method of communication now that cell phones have come out. And, you know, there's a lot more people involved in cell phones than there was any of that other kind of communication.
Yeah. What about, let's go to the debates. Are there too many of them? And is the Republican National Committee right to intercede with the networks?
When this started out 4 years ago, when Reince Priest took over as national chairman, he was going to run it based upon the proposition that 18 debates with Republicans tearing themselves apart in 2012 was maybe one of the reasons Romney didn't get elected. Not the only reason, but one of the reasons. So, boy, we were going to control them. We were only going to have four or five of them. We weren't going to have 18. We've already had three, and there's a whole bunch more scheduled. So why did National Committee change their mind that they were going to run it, turn it over to the networks? And then you see what happened. It's an insult to journalism, the questions that were asked on CNBC. And then you saw the reaction of the candidates, almost every one of them, speaking about how irrelevant the questions were and how personal the questions were, and in some cases how idiotic the presidents were. You know, it's just like, how come nobody during the presidential debate ever asked Hillary why she misled the people with the film the night of Benghazi, the same night she was emailing her daughter that the Benghazi attack was a terrorist attack. It had nothing to do with the film. The next day, she notified the president of Egypt it was a terrorist attack. But for the next 3 weeks, this administration was talking about the film causing the people to riot there in Benghazi. But they don't ask her that. But they ask one Republican candidate whether they think another Republican candidate is morally right to person to be president of the United States. So then you have the reaction of the candidates. So last night they had a meeting, or yesterday they had a meeting in Alexandria, Virginia, about 10 out of the candidates for president. Their staff met, and now they're going to take control and tell people with the networks how the next debate's going to be run. And they're a little bit irritated, I think, with the Republican National Committee, because they gave that up when 4 years ago they said they were going to control it so the mistakes of 2012 weren't made in 2016. So I don't know how it's going to come out now, but that's what these candidates have agreed that they're going to do.
Well, I mean, and I'll be honest with you. I saw a part of the CNBC. I didn't watch all of it because it's just, I'm not ready for the run for the White House yet. But I watched the first two. I watched this one at the end, and I'll agree with you. It was, the questions were remedial and had really nothing to do with it. It was like they were, and I don't know how much some of the candidates brought this up, they were baiting candidates to argue. That's what I felt, that they wanted Trump to start arguing and start slamming the other candidates. You know, this whole thing so far has been all the networks. You know, it's Trump, 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 Trump. We've got an exclusive with Trump. I mean, the other candidates really aren't getting their fair share of anything, in my opinion.
In the CNBC interview, debate, it seemed like at least two of the three journalists were entering the debate as well.
Yeah, it just, how do you think Trump's conducted himself in this campaign?
He has handled himself the way Trump has handled himself all of his life in his business dealings and on TV, and you wouldn't expect him to be any different as a candidate.
You think that's a good thing?
I would like to suggest three things to him, and I could suggest some things to each one of the candidates. But in regard to I'll just suggest two things. One, I think he ought to talk a little bit more about his understanding of how the Constitution requires the federal government to operate, the division between the president, the judges, and the legislative branch. And secondly, we have some problems in this country. How will he, what will he offer to solve those problems? Now, I know he would say immediately he's put out a tax program. Okay, that's one thing. And then he announced something yesterday that I'm not up on yet, that I would have to say that he's probably given some responses to the problems that are facing the nation. But I'd like to hear him say, what kind of, is he going to appoint strict constructionists to the Supreme Court? Because we're going to have three or four vacancies on the Supreme Court in the next term of office, as an example.
Senator, you, your Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act cleared the Judiciary Committee about 10 days ago.
15-5. It's a very bipartisan bill.
Yeah, and there's word that, you know, when some of these minor offenders are going to be released, that there's going to be buses waiting for them if they're from a different country, and they're going to deport them to Mexico. But do you know anything about that?
Well, they should be deported. In fact, we got there's thousands of people that have been held for deportation that under a Supreme Court decision of a few years ago that ought to be reversed. And I don't know whether we'll ever get it reversed, but we could by law reverse it, that says you can only hold them so long. So we've had people that have been convicted of murder turned loose into society here because you can't, if the country won't take them back, then you just can't send them there. And our State Department has plenty of pressure that they could put on the countries to take them back, like withholding federal aid or withholding visas from people in that country that want to come to the United States. But the State Department isn't doing any of that. So if you can't get the country to receive these criminals or people that have violated our, and most of them, well, no, I don't want to say most. Some have criminal records, but some have violated our laws by coming here undocumented. So if they won't take them back, then they're turned loose into American society based on this Supreme Court decision, which doesn't seem to be right to me. But it's still the law of the land at this point. At least that decision is binding if it isn't the law of the land, because Congress writes the laws. Anyway, so that's the situation that we have right now. And so let's see how that relates to my sentencing bill. Don't forget that under a presidential directive that I believe is constitutional, there's going to be 46,000 cases of drug-related people being in prison if they aren't a threat to society. And that's going to, and if they're a threat to society, that's going to be determined by a judge, not by not by the President of the United States, then they can get early release. Now, right now, 6,000 of the 40-some thousand have crossed that hurdle, probably been in halfway houses for a while anyway. They've got their freedom as of November the 1st. And so what our legislation does, not so much about past as it does about future drug-related cases involving imprisonment. It's going to give judges a little more discretion than they have today on what we call mandatory minimums. But what I got compromised and found a consensus on was between a group of senators that think mandatory minimums shouldn't be changed at all and another bipartisan group of very right-wing Republicans and left-wing Democrats that have felt that we ought to cut the mandatory minimums right in half. I didn't see either extreme being the right extreme. So I came up with this compromise of giving judges some more discretion based upon the other criminal indictments that people have, whether it's drug-related or how serious a drug-related crime is, that maybe would give some exceptions to mandatory minimums. But it would be through a judge having more discretion than he presently has now. That's one part of the bill. Then another part of the bill that might benefit the people that you've asked about, the people that could be released into society for past crimes, because our law is about the future. There's prison reform in this bill. Right now, mandatory minimums have to be served 100%. If this is going to give people an opportunity, making points for good behavior, for going to school, for getting job retraining, things that are going to point to reduction of recidivism if they get out. And again, they won't get out unless a judge says that they should get out. The prison reform part of it allows people that are in prison under mandatory minimums to maybe get out a little bit earlier.
Let's switch and go to Russia. And what should... Is this a good thing that they're over there? And And when I say it's a good thing, I know that it complicates things a lot. Okay. But are they serving a purpose over there, or...
Well, let me give you a one-sentence answer, and then you can follow it up, because I think we can go into a lot deeper than my one-sentence answer. But for 40 years, the foreign policy and military policy of the United States was to keep Russia out of the Middle East, and we did keep them out of the Middle East. Now, there's a vacuum there because we haven't been as active in the Middle East as we normally have been. And in diplomacy and military action, nature doesn't like a vacuum, so it's going to be filled. So Russia's filled that vacuum and make it a very dangerous situation. But more importantly, it has hurt the United States, not per se, but it's hurt the United States with regard to our friends over there like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the Emirates, and Israel. It looks like we're less concerned about it, and being less concerned about it, a more dangerous environment for those people. Maybe not more dangerous for the United States, but more dangerous for them. I better back up and say it's more dangerous to the United States in the sense that ISIS is, through social networking, communicating with thousands of American, mostly young people, I believe, and trying to entice them into joining their ranks. And once they decide to, you kind of like a fish taking a bite. If they take a bite, then they go to encrypted methods of communication with the people that have taken the bite, and then we kind of lose track of them. But there's thousands of people we know ISIS is communicating through social networking here in the United States. So that's what's happening now, right now, with Russia being in the Middle East.
You bring up another. Why do we let them? Why can't we disconnect their internet? I mean, isn't that a possibility?
If other countries can do it, I assume we can do it. And I say I assume we do it because even though I tweet a lot and Instagram and use my internet an awful lot, I'm not sure I know the mechanics of it. And I don't want to say for sure, but if other countries can do it, we can probably do it. But it's completely contrary to the way we've advertised the network, or I mean the internet, not only for social networking, but for commercial purposes and efficiency of operation. And we think the freedom of the internet is one of the best things that's ever happened for communication in America and for the economy of America. And we don't want other countries to do it, so I think it would set a bad example if we did it. But could we do it? Possibly.
Well, Yeah, it's just I understand what you're saying and everything, but I mean it's when it's this much of a security risk, and it is, then I'm not. I don't know. I'm all for freedom of speech, but it's getting to be a little ridiculous. And then they have that the British guy that's fighting now on the side of Al Qaeda against ISIS, and they ask his mother, you know, what she thought, and she goes, "Well, at least he's fighting, you know, against ISIS." And it's just bizarre.
Yeah.
He's fighting with Al Qaeda.
Yeah. Well, in either case, it's an extreme form of Islam that I'm sure most people in Islam don't appreciate, because it gives the whole religion a bad name. But out of the, you know, one time I heard from the FBI the figure of 23,000 people that ISIS was communicating with in America, probably just a few hundred or maybe even a few dozen, then get into encrypted communication with ISIS. And it's that point where we kind of go dark. And I hope that somehow the FBI has a capability of monitoring those people. But it's not quite as easy as if you could go to court and get a court order and say, we want to get in on these telephone communications, because now Apple has this privacy factor that even Apple can't get into your own telephone. And so then you're up against Americans' appreciation of privacy, and that appreciation of privacy can probably somehow put in jeopardy the national security and the protection of some Americans that the FBI, if they had the ability to get into it, would otherwise be able to protect Americans to a greater extent. Now, I happen to know in some cases around the July 4th, when you were told that there could be terrorist attacks in the United States, that in several instances, and I'm not sure that the FBI, how the FBI did this, and if they knew, they probably wouldn't tell me unless it was in a very secured environment. But they did stop some of those people. I could give you some details on a couple. Somebody in Boston that got killed as he was going to knife some policeman is one example. But I'm not sure how they got the information, considering the fact that the whole communications went black after they got into the encrypted environment.
Yeah, it's complicated and confusing, and I'd rather hear the candidates talk about, you know, on both sides, more about this and what we're going to do than picking on each other. Let me ask you a parting question. And, you know, I'm a Democrat, but what do you think of Sanders, Bernie Sanders?
You know, if you really have a conversation with him, it can be a very good conversation. And he is funny sometimes when you talk to him. I like to call him Mike. When I get on the elevator with him, and, you know, very seldom do Americans talk to each other on an elevator. But when I get on an elevator with him, I call him my constituent, because he's in Iowa so much. And he gets a kick out of it. I say, you know, you get more people at your town meetings than I do. And he gets a kick out of it. And he asks me then, when am I going to endorse him? Well, obviously, I'm not going to endorse him. But that's the sort of a conversation you have, and it is kind of fun. But nobody would, I think, just looking at him and hearing him as a candidate, you wouldn't think that he could be that personable.
I don't think he can accomplish anything that he's telling these people that he can accomplish.
No, but don't we have a lot of presidential candidates that you could put into that category?
That's true. But he just, to me, is just, he's just, you know, way out there.
Yeah.
I don't know that we need a revolution And I don't know that all the, all corporations are, we get this all the time. All corporations are bad. All business people are bad. It's an us against the, and I don't buy that. I don't buy that theory. Corporations, for the most part, aren't bad. People own corporations. That's how we invest. That's the country that we live in.
I explain corporations this way. They're a sheet of paper that organizes something. It organizes stockholders. It organizes stockholders hiring management. And it provides jobs for lots of workers. So there are corporations are people, as you just said, but it's it starts out as a sheet of paper.
Yeah, and I just hate that us versus them mentality.
Yeah,
I just don't like it. But you
got to remember, President Obama ran on a platform of optimism and unifying. He's ended up being one of the biggest dividers, presidents that have divided the country into different groups, and the people turn out to be very pessimistic.
I like the guy, but I mean, which side you're coming from, things are, for whatever reason, when you have people like, John Boehner, is leaving pretty well and has said, we got to get along in this country. He's been actually very unifying, and it's sad to see him go, especially when it's a handful of people in the party that are, these people don't reflect the Republican Party that my grandparents believed in. They were moderate, like you. They can communicate across the aisle. You can have a conversation, we just don't get that and the same thing on the other side, Pelosi. Pelosi, even though I'm a Democrat, Pelosi doesn't represent me whatsoever. It'd be neat if we could get back in the middle again.
I think what you just added to the debate is that we aren't as civil as we ought to be.
And, well, we really are.
But remember, part of that is because your profession and TV and journalism, and then, of course, politicians contribute to this, but all you hear about is division, people squabbling. If people knew how I get along with some Democrats better than some Republicans, and we can discuss things in a very peaceful manner when we aren't debating, but my working with Baucus will say for 10 years running the Finance Committee and all but three or four bills that got out of committee were bipartisan bills. But when people are getting along, you never read about that on the front page of the newspapers or at the beginning of a 5-minute radio program. You're always hearing about controversy. So people, there is too much controversy, I have to admit, but there's not as much as what people think because they only see the disagreements. They never see the agreements.
You think Paul will do a good job?
Yes, without a doubt. Both from a standpoint of bringing people together and from good policy.
Senator, thank you so much. And again, thank you very much, and thank Nick for the tour. We really, really enjoyed it.
I will thank Nick for the tour. You bet.
All right.
Okay,
thank you.
Goodbye.